and welcome to the first episode of Radio Solidarity. This is a show produced by the Worker Solidarity Movement for broadcast on Near FM 90.3. The aim of this show is to highlight a range of social struggles that people in Ireland and across the world are involved in and which don't get covered very well in the media. Tonight we're going to be looking at issues around space and property. I'm Pádraig, and in the studio with me tonight are Dermo.
Hi.
Mark. How's it going? And Mick.
Hey.
A little later, we're going to be talking about the property market, subprime lending, the threat of evictions and repossessions, and how people in East Boston are resisting that. Right now, we're going to talk to Mick and Mark from Shombrospree, which is a social centre based here in Dublin. Mick, first of all, can you tell us what a social centre actually is?
Yeah, social centres basically come about when people get together to rent or squat a building so they can create a space for the kinds of things that often can't happen because of the price of property and the difficulty in accessing space that property speculation creates. So you'll find them in most European cities, including Dublin, and there'll be a host of activities going on, including community activism, cultural activities, political and social events and that kind of thing.
Mark, can you tell me a little bit more specifically about Shombrospree?
Yeah, Shombrospree is a collective of the people who have been involved as a project that's been around for 4 years. It came directly out of the experiences of people organising a mobilisation around the summer of 2004, May Day 2004. It was the first time a lot of us had kind of worked together, and we kind of realised that in order to both politically organise, we needed physical resources, but also that there was very little space in the city to kind of socialise that didn't involve spending a lot of money. So it was kind of a way of imagining our collective politics, but also trying to build something new in the city, and maybe Mick could give us a wee bit more.
Yeah, well, Shombrospree basically came out of what Mark was talking about there, and people decided to rent a building in order to create a space where those kind of activities which normally you can't really happen in Dublin because of the prohibitive price of property and rent in spaces. And over the years there's been a few different buildings and really like a never-ending list of activities have gone on there, everything from cabaret to cafe events to political meetings, film screenings, all sorts of things really.
Okay, following on from that, what do you think the role of social centres in cities are, and why do people get involved in them?
Well, I mean, if you look at what's happened in Dublin over the last 15 years or so, the city has basically been turned into a kind of giant shopping centre, and the price of property has gone through the roof. So it's become almost impossible to do anything that doesn't involve spending all your money, and social centres basically provide an alternative to that. So it's basically a completely different model of how to go about doing things. So first of all, we don't do things for profit. We try to organise events and activities that respond to people's needs, that people enjoy, and that are empowering. And second of all, there's a full political participation there. So everything's done on a directly democratic way. It's non-hierarchical. So being involved in Shombrospree, it's really completely different to life normally in Dublin City, because it's all about being fully participating in social and political life, really.
Yeah, just and follow on from that as well. It's like, I think it's kind of, for a lot of us who are kind of got involved with the project at the start, we've never actually been involved in something that you actually created yourself. I think we're quite used to being consumers in society, but the ability for people to get together and start to create projects for themselves from very little resources has been a really empowering process, I think, for everybody involved as well.
I notice here it says that you're on your website that it's an anti-capitalist space. So does that mean anybody can show up, or is there some specific something specific you have to sign into when you actually come along?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we have a very broad understanding of the term anti-capitalist. So there's some people who'd have a very kind of clear idea that they want to be involved in struggles against, the various negative elements of capitalism. But there'd also be people involved who just find the kinds of activities that are going on interesting and enjoyable. So really for us, anti-capitalism is anybody who really finds what's going on in the city in terms of how much you have to pay for a simple thing like having a cup of tea, in terms of having a social life and in terms of having a place to live, if people, basically, if you don't like that, and if you've ever thought this is way too expensive and being ripped off, then a social centre is the place for you.
Okay, so if somebody wanted to get involved or visit the Shomer, how would they go about doing that?
Shomer, it's got, the new building we have now is a premises on 10 Belvedere Court, which is just off Gardner Street, the North Inner City. We've also got a website called shomerspree.org. And email there if you're interested in getting involved. If you want to email us or some kind of events you want to put on, is shomerspreeevents@gmail.com. And we also have open meetings every Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. If you fancy coming along, you'll get food there as well.
Okay, cheers for that, folks. Now we've got a pre-recorded piece. First of all, Aileen gives a quick rundown on the effects of subprime lending in Ireland. Following that, we hear from Diane, an anarchist from East Boston, about how people there are trying to resist house repossessions and forced evictions.
Radio Solidarity, a new world in our hearts.
The recent recession has led to more and more people getting into financial difficulty. There has been a rise in people defaulting on their mortgage payments. Increasingly, lenders are going to court to try and secure payment or to get possession orders so they can repossess houses and evict the occupants. Over the course of 2007, there were a total of 108 possession orders issued by the High Court. By the middle of this year, that number had already been exceeded. We all know that the Celtic Tiger was marked by a massive rise in house prices. As the price of the houses went up, so did the level of debt that people had to take on in order to afford homes. Banking practices were changed to allow people to borrow higher sums. Deposits became less important and rafts of new lending products were launched, including 100% mortgages and interest-only mortgages. The result was that mainstream lenders loaned much higher amounts and asked for much less security than they had in the past. However open the banks became, there were always those people who could still not get a mortgage from them. Many of these turned to lenders such as GE Money, NUA, Smart Mortgages or IIB Home Loans. These subprime lenders provided mortgages to borrowers who did not meet the usual criteria for being granted bank loans. We tend to think of subprime lending as something that happened in the United States and something that sparked the current world financial crisis. But it has also been happening on a large scale in Ireland. If we take Start Mortgages, for example, since they came into the Irish market in 2004, it has loaned over 1.5 billion euros. That amount covers 11,000 mortgages. Start and other subprime lenders generate funds by grouping these mortgages into packages and selling them on to third-party investors. Start raised over 900 million by doing this twice in 2006. They also make money by charging their borrowers above average interest rates. They justify these charges by pointing out that they lend to people other banks won't touch because they are too high risk. And indeed, they are high risk. Of the mortgages that Start gave out from 2007 onwards, over a quarter are more than 30 days in arrears, with more than 16% at least 19 days overdue. Smart Mortgages have taken more customers to court to secure payment than any of its competitors. In fact, they've taken over 50% of such cases, more than all their competitors combined. Up to now, even if granted, possession orders don't always result in eviction and repossession. Again, using Start as an example, they've been granted well over 100 orders, but claim to have only 20 repossessions. When judges grant repossession orders, they often put a hold or a stay on them for a number of months. This gives people a chance to try and come up with the money or to make a deal with their lender. These deals have commonly been that the house is sold and the mortgage is repaid that way. The person who sold their house may move out or could even end up paying rent to the new owner. With the current fall in house prices, however, people who borrowed a house last year might not be able to pay off their loan by selling it this year. In a tightening economic climate, we could see the rate of forced repossessions and evictions jump up, as banks and lenders try to recover as much of their bad debt as possible. For example, in Britain, repossessions are up 71% in last year, and in October, there was an estimated 500,000 Americans in the process of losing their home. Obviously, this can have a devastating effect on families and communities. During the summer, I met Diana, an anarchist in Boston. She and others are fighting back against the banks and organising to prevent evictions and repossessions. In the following interview, she tells me about the way subprime lenders there targeted people who couldn't repay loans, the way they tried to repossess people's homes, and what action she and others take to defend people against the banks. I think you'll find it very interesting.
In this one specific eviction that we tried to block, it's like an elderly couple that lived there, but their whole family was with them. So their children and their grandchildren. The grandchildren were all crying. It was very upsetting for them, you know, to be seeing this. It was very traumatizing for them. And the banks didn't want to negotiate with them because this family had basically offered to keep on living in their house, to pay rent to the bank, or to even buy the property up for the appraised value of the house, but not necessarily the market. And this family was saying, like, we don't know where to go today. We have nowhere to go. And this house is going to be, you know, that night, that house was going to be empty. The thing is because of the housing crisis, you know, no one's buying property because there's no money. And so this house is going to be empty for months and months and months, probably. And at the same time, this family has nowhere to go. It makes no sense. It's crazy. It's just, you know, frustrating. And it's just, you know, another way of how capitalism, you know, fucks us over. Like, the banks are being bailed out for millions and billions of dollars. And at the same time, those people who have been tricked by those banks, you know, and are losing their homes, they're not the ones being bailed out. So it makes no sense. I live in East Boston, which is a predominantly Latino neighborhood. So it's mostly people from Central America that live here. What we've seen is that these subprime mortgages were really targeted at people of color and working class people who otherwise wouldn't necessarily be able to afford a house. You can see it very much in my community. Just by walking down the street, any street, you can see house after house that's just been abandoned, that the, you know, it's been foreclosed by the bank. You know, the people have been kicked out and they're just empty. And it's just like, it's kind of frightening to see because it's just one house after another. And it's a continuing crisis that's, you know, it's still happening at the moment. This organization, City Life, was like, they're dealing in another neighborhood right now. And so they kind of asked us for our help. So it was me and two other comrades started the campaign in East Boston. So what we do is we organize biweekly meetings where those people who are interested in getting more information and like getting involved in the campaign, they come to these meetings and then we give them like more information about what they can do. Once the foreclosure process begins, the bank will offer tenants like $1,000 to leave the house. Mostly, you know, since people don't know what's happening or anything, most people just accept this money and leave. And what we do is we tell the people that they should not accept this money. They should not leave their house. They also get a notice from the bank saying that they have till such and such date to stay in that house. And, you know, we tell them that this letter is not a legal document. It looks like a legal document and it is very scary if you don't know what it is. And so people just, you know, accept the money and leave. We tell them not to accept the money, not to leave their house, and to actually appear at the court date to fight this eviction. So then the whole legal process starts, and it can take up to, you know, 6 months till the final decision happens in court. So in this 6 months, these people can live in their house without paying any rent because the landlord's now the bank. And so they save, you know, they save them the money of the rent, and they save all that time that they can, you know, look for another place or whatever. The times that, you know, there's been an eviction blockade and finally the courts ruled that, you know, the family has to leave their house, the cases that I've seen and that I've, you know, the families that I've spoken with, they don't know where to go. So, you know, a constable comes, evicts them, and they don't know where to go. There's no places to go. There's no help. Because of this crisis, all the homeless shelters in Boston are full. So there's no place in homeless shelters either. So basically, you know, people are getting kicked out of their house and just onto the street. The thing is in my neighborhood, it's mostly, you know, tenants that are renting property. But in other neighborhoods in Boston, you know, there are people who actually, you know, have lived in the house for a while and they're paying a mortgage. And because of the interest rates, they can't keep on paying the mortgage. So it's whole families. And they've, you know, and these families, the thing is like they go to court, they try to negotiate with the banks, and the banks don't want to negotiate with families. Basically, they want to kick, you know, they'd rather kick people out on the street than negotiate with them. So it's families, yeah. You know, once the whole legal process is finalized in court and the court decides to hand the eviction papers to, you know, the people who are residing in the house, give those eviction papers to the family. And it's normally in the morning. So what we do is, you know, we call as many people, get as many people as we can to be at the property that morning. And there's always like a picket, there's always chanting, and there's some people who are willing to get arrested on that day, so they'll block maybe the entrance, so the constable. So there's been about 10 of these blockades in Boston, and 8 of them have been successful. So the constable has called the banks and been like, look, there's, you know, there's 100 people here, I don't know what to do. And the bank just says, okay, forget it, we'll deal with this later. But usually that's what happens. There's a lot of people kind of in the entrance, moving, making noise, and then there's people that maybe have chained themselves onto like the fence or in the hallway and into the property so the constable can't get in. Usually they have a lot of local support. I mean, it's not just people from the organization City Life and other kind of activists, but it's usually also people from the community that are like suffering the same thing or seeing their neighbors being evicted. So it is something that, you know, people, you know, understand. It's not something that's like abstract for, you know, for people, or they can't, or it's hard to mobilize people to. It's something that is very real. You know, more people are willing to go out to something like that. It's happening everywhere. I mean, it's happening all over the country. Boston isn't even like one of the highest ones. I think it's like Florida and California are the states that have the highest numbers of foreclosures. But even in Massachusetts, there are other places. I mean, it's always the same kind of like the cities that have the highest foreclosure rates have like the same kind of makeup, you know, working class, people of color. And, you know, they've obviously been targeted, but it's just, like, it's a very big epidemic.
Okay, folks, there's quite a lot there. Anybody got anything they'd like to comment on?
I guess what struck me is that, like, even now, the early start of the 21st century, people still have to work all their lives just to have a house over their head, even though it's been accepted for a hell of a long time that housing is a right under the, you know, for example, the Human Rights Declaration. Yet now we have people getting turfed out of their homes right across like the so-called Western democratic countries. It just seems slightly bizarre. Not just unjust as well. And I mean, I guess what I'd like hope to encourage and like to see is people actively resisting this, like they are attempting to do in Boston. And as always, it's the interest in sort of movements in this comes from the bottom up is when like people start building communities themselves.
The other interesting thing to note about it, Mark, was from the discussion that there's practically no social housing has been built in this country, despite the fact that we're at the end of an economic boom. Last year they set a record, which is quite quite laughable, but they actually built 13,000 social houses in a country of 4.5 million at the end of one of the best parts of economic prosperity that it's ever enjoyed in its history. It's laughable the amount of time and planning that went into actually social housing. So even though it's a basic right, it doesn't seem to be addressed at all by the current government, and it's certainly not going to be addressed going forward. But you get to a stage where you have developers now coming on radio shows and saying, what we really need to start doing is building social housing. But they weren't building social housing for the last 10 years, so it's hilarious the way they approach that.
And another thing that's kind of just quite straight in your face, like, is the idea that bailiffs are going to turn up at your gaff. They're going to turn up probably with the police. And if you don't agree to move out of their house, they're going to drag you out of the house. And then that night, that same night, that house is just left empty. You've got like lots of empty space, and you're going to see this right across the city. It's like, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's very much the situation that Chalmers Bree, the social centre project, was responding to as well. Because one of the things that, as Mark was saying, Diana was talking about there, is the fact that you have this real, really ridiculous situation where massive amounts of buildings are left empty, whether that's housing or whether that's other types of buildings that could be used for different things. And not only is it seen as crazy, but it's also illegal to try and use those buildings for another purpose just because you might not have enough money to buy them. So in terms of social centre politics, and in terms of politics more generally, I think we really have to reverse that situation and show that what's crazy is leaving all that space empty.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, the thing is this stuff as well, like these people have like names and faces, you know. This whole idea that like money was given out to people who they knew quite well weren't going to be able to pay it back. You know, smart, I think they were called, like have been handing out mortgages like sweets. And the reality is they're playing with people's lives. They're trying to profit from people who don't have a lot in the first place. You know, it's picking the most vulnerable people in our society, those who are like don't have stable jobs, and they're just being preyed upon.
It's exactly, and the other aspect that is strange to look at right now is that every taxpayer in Ireland, according to the latest idea about refinancing banks with 10 billion, is going to pay 4,000 euros. So a taxpayer is going to basically give a loan to the banks to get their finances back up because they've given out these bad loans. But at the same time, you have companies which are taking back houses and making people homeless while we have a load of people homeless in the streets already. One of the things that I think it also highlights is that when you get engaged in struggle, that's where you actually start to build a sense of community. And I think that comes across from the piece in East Boston. And what Diana constantly says is it makes no sense. And quite often, when we say, as anarchists, we say property is theft. And initially, that statement doesn't make any sense. But I think that what we've shown in the program today is that as soon as you actually privatize space, you actually take a function out of it and you actually make it difficult for people to access simple needs like housing and shelter, then you are actually stealing from people. And it's exactly the same thing that's happened. So I hope that people start getting involved in struggles to actually maintain their houses and maybe, you know, to make sure that they don't get thrown out of their houses and to actually start taking that property back for themselves. And I think that's what social centres do. They start taking back space within the city, which should exist for groups to do community work and for groups to congregate and, you know, social spaces. There is no social spaces out there. So I think that's an important thing to remember.
Yeah, another point there, just in terms of what's relevant for what's happening in Dublin now is with the recession and the crisis, you hear a lot of talk about this is going to affect everybody the same. But in terms of what's going on in Boston, obviously it's not affecting everybody the same. In fact, it's leading to an emphasized or a growing conflict between sectors of society, between the vast majority of people who have to spend an awful lot of money just to have a house and the tiny minority of people who make an even more massive amount of money because they control that property. And I think that's something we can expect to see here as well.
Yeah, it's really clear there's a class divide in terms of how who this is affecting most and what way it's going on.
It's also, I mean, it's also a question of ownership, and I think the ownership starts to happen at an early stage when people actually can afford it. And property was one of those things where people got into it to make a huge amount of money, a huge amount of profits. But it doesn't actually address the issues that underlie that, which is basic stuff around rights, around social housing, around communities being built for with the help of that community, with the consultation with that community. And also another thing that was neatly illustrated, if we're looking at Dublin specifically, is it's okay for developers to enter into agreements with Dublin City Council, but when they reach a situation where they don't think they can make profits out of it, it's quite acceptable for them to pull it out, as we witnessed with McNamara when they were supposed to develop St. Michael's Estate and they're supposed to develop Devonhy Gardens, and they just pulled out because the regulations changed, which meant that they actually had to build bigger apartments or bigger flats. And at a time when the property market was going down, it wasn't in his interest anymore, Mr. McNamara's interest anymore, to do that. So he just cancelled.
I mean, yet again, it's another glaring example of profit motive is a shit way to organise society. And like the idea that we actually live in democracies where we have the ability to choose and to organise our lives, just is showing off for the lie that it is continually, whether it be the cuts in our health services, whether it be the state of housing now, whether it be asked to vote again in another referendum because he didn't get it right the first time. I mean, there's only so many times that people can sit back and say, well, actually, you know, we have the ability to shape our lives. We don't have the ability to shape our lives, but the only way that we will is when people start to act together. And not in the sort of old way that authoritarian political parties on the left might have tried to do it, but it's about grassroots community action, where people feel empowered and breaking out of this individualised circumstances as well. Because what I think one of the biggest problems, particularly in the housing issue, is you're going to have all these isolated families who are going to be kicked out of their houses, and they're not actually connected to each other. Mm. They share probably the same financial circumstances, even though stories are quite individual as well. The one thing they have in common is they've fallen victims to private banks and to private individuals who head those banks, own the shares in those banks, trying to profit off human misery. The only way this can possibly change is when people start to collectivise that notion of themselves as, like, not just them being under attack, but a whole layer, the vast majority of people actually being under attack in society through the actions and the motivations of a very small elite, not just in this country, but right across the globe.
I agree. It shouldn't be just in the interest of developers who can tear up contracts. Why can't people tear up contracts as well?
Exactly.
They bought a house that is now, you know, it's half the value that it was. Let's tear up the contract and talk about, you know, paying back what they can afford. Like, why does it work both? It has to work both ways, but unfortunately it doesn't. It makes no sense. Just like Diana says, it makes no sense.
Okay, I think that brings us almost to the end of the show. I hope that was enjoyable. If you want to learn more about the Worker Solidarity Movement, you can check us out on the web at www.wsm.ie. While you're online, you can also look up Seomra's Free at www.seomraspraoi.org. We're going to leave you now with some pre-recorded comment on the recent budget and what the government's new plan for property is. We'll be back next month. Hope you will too.
Property is theft. According to a recent poll by Permanent TSB and the Economic Social Research Institute, the average house price has, for the first time in many years, collapsed. Well, not collapsed, but it's been reduced by 10%. So now the average price of a house would cost you €234,648. So that's easy. I know you've all got $234,000 stuck in your back pocket. But if you don't, what you would have to do is you'd have to go to the banks and ask them for a mortgage or a loan.
But things seem to have changed in the banking world there recently. I mean, imagine now if I walked into the bank and asked for €234,648, the bank manager's probably going to say,
exactly. But fear not, folks, because the government has a plan. And that plan was announced recently in the recovery budget.
The bloodbath budget, you mean?
It's called the Home Choice Loan, and it allows you to borrow up to 92% of the value of your new home over a 30-year term. And that new home can be up to the value of €285,000. The applicant must have a minimum income of €40,000. The other thing that's interesting about this home choice loan is that he must have heard no from two commercial banks.
But that sounds very much like subprime lending, like one of the major features of this crisis that we're currently undergoing that's causing all these cuts.
The other feature of the home choice loan is that it can only be for new properties, newly developed homes.
So that seems like it's only going to benefit developers rather than people who are actually looking for homes.
Why would this government want to help developers?
Radio Solidarity.